hey, this is Matt, and I'm really feeling a hot dog right now, so I'm going to go up to North Center and eat a hot dog and listen to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Matt. I love it. I hear the sleigh bells. It's that time of the year. Fantastic. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 949. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. So hello to Bob. And again, it is wonderful to be here with you today. Coming up on Christmas, happy holidays, whatever you're celebrating. On the show today, we discover the secret history of a very cool 1970s country rock band from right here in Chicago, and we dive into a new report that examines how Chicago isn't enforcing its own environmental regulations when it comes to city contracts. Hey, speaking of the environment, earlier this week, part of the construction site formerly known as the Chicago Tribune Freedom Center printing plant collapsed into the Chicago River. This is the site where the new casino is being built. Eyewitness accounts say that a wall fell into the river and formed a white cloud that looked like packing peanuts in the water. Authorities are investigating what happened and what that material that fell into the water actually is. In a statement, the city buildings department said it, quote, has required the contractor to prepare a corrective action plan for the continued demolition, end quote. Now, look, I know the Chicago River isn't the cleanest of waterways. Remember how there was that idea to have a swimming competition in the river not too long ago and how they had to scrap that idea because, well, the water wasn't clean enough for humans to swim in? I'm not knocking the idea of swimming in the river. I think it's great if it's safe. There's an organization called Chicago River Swim. I spoke to someone on this show from that group back in 2017 on Outside the Loop number 543, available on OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com. And there's been real momentum to make a swim happen in the Chicago River. However, I mentioned that coming up on the program today, I'll be talking about a report that shows how Chicago isn't enforcing its own environmental regulations regarding city contracts. And I think this ties into what so many of us have been feeling lately. Not the urge to swim in the Chicago River, although, hey, if you're feeling that, I'm not going to stop you, but I might just say think twice. I'm talking about frustration with government. When we pay taxes, we have a reasonable expectation that our money will be used responsibly and for the public good. I know it doesn't always work out that way, but it seems like more often than not, there is mismanagement, especially in Chicago. Now, I don't have data to back that up. I'm sure there are many instances where our money is put to good use, but the vibes of mismanagement are strong these days. And like it or not, elected representatives have to overcome those feelings by their good actions. I believe the government has the capacity to do good for all of us, and I believe in the power of the free press to keep the government honest. Santa, bring us some good government under the tree this year, as Outside the Loop brings you, the lovely listener, a stocking stuffer of quality local conversation. Onward with the show, and happy holidays. Threats to our environment are real, and they are ongoing, and we all have a role to play when it comes to impacting our environment. Take the issue of air pollution, industry emissions, exhaust from trucks and trains. All this is the human impact on the environment, but we can also work to better our environment. Some areas of Chicago are disproportionately impacted by pollution, and the city has been working to fix this, although there have been some bumps in the road. There was a recent story in the Chicago Sun-Times about how politics can impede the mission of environmental justice. Anthony Moser is the board president for the Neighbors for Environmental Justice. That's a group advocating for environmental justice on the southwest side of Chicago. They are online, n4ej.org. Anthony is here with us again on Outside the Loop. Anthony, welcome back.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
You got it. You know, we were talking a couple of years ago here on this program about what was going on the southwest side, where you are in terms of the environment. What is it like? What are the current environmental conditions on the southwest side of Chicago?
Well, not great, I guess would be the short way to put it. You know, we are overburdened with the industrial corridors. We've got the highway going right through. We also have intermodal facilities, so where there's stuff coming in off diesel traffic as well. So there's a lot of different overlapping connected sources of air pollution that are contributing, and it causes a lot of problems. One of the big ones here in our neighborhood, of course, is Matt Asphalt, which is right across the street from McKinley Park. So, you know, even just trying to go walk around in the park and, you know, get some fresh air. And, you know, that can be an experience where instead you've got kind of, you know, I imagine people know the experience of like driving through road work,
right,
with the windows down. So that having that kind of experience when you're just walking around, you know, in the park, it's not great for anybody, but it's also pretty upsetting.
Right. Not so fresh air. Right. I mean, you've got. Just these industry facilities there. You've got the trucks, and as you say, these intermodal facilities that all contribute to pollution, and that really has a health impact. And we've talked about that before. There is a health impact when it comes to this, and that's been documented. And so, you know, just thinking about what the city's been doing here, there was a plan in place to try to monitor air pollution in your neighborhood by using these sensors. So I want to ask you about, first of all, what was this plan? And then what ended up happening with this plan?
Yeah, so the city's progress, such as it is on these fronts, is really largely been in response to ongoing community organizing. By groups for decades, really, across the city, trying to force some kind of change. And in this case, the air monitoring network in question is something that was included specifically in a federal agreement that was signed last year between the city and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, mm-hmm. where there were a lot of very specific commitments made. Some of them were about the ways of finishing the cumulative impact assessment, changing some things around planning and development, because there's a recognition that a lot of this is driven by the city's land use and development policies that push these kinds of heavy industry into certain communities and keep them out of other places.
Right.
And one of the requirements of that agreement was to set up an air monitoring network. And to do that in collaboration with community groups who would then have oversight, essentially, of where the monitors would be placed and could be participants in determining how to engage with that data and to make sure that it was being effectively shared and communicated.
So that was the plan. And I know that there were about 140 air pollution sensors across the city. But what ended up happening here? How did this go down? How did politics impact this plan?
The plan has the project has been moving forward, and a lot of groups have been putting in time. There was a lot of time spent determining, for example, what would be the best kind of sensor that we could get that would have kind of the right set of constraints around collecting important data. We wanted something that would be able to operate without needing a lot of maintenance, something that could be put up ideally with like solar panels to be somewhat independent, open up more possibilities for where you could put them. A lot of different constraints around trying to figure out sort of the best options. And the monitors had been selected, these Clarity monitors, and they've been purchased, and the city has them. And the plan as of early November was that participants in the project were going to be getting together to kind of open them up, go through them, start putting things together. We're still, you know, we have not yet determined where the monitors are supposed to go. And the day before that meeting was supposed to happen to unbox them and to, you know, start putting them together, literally, we learned that the CDPH staffer who was basically, you know, the point person on the project coordinating with all the different community groups no longer worked for the Department of Public Health. That was, you know, like I said, that was November 7th is when we got the message about that. And we still don't know who is supposed to be in charge of air monitoring on the city side. We don't know when we're supposed to be meeting again. There were originally hopes to have the monitors deployed in January, but that seems pretty unlikely given the lack of communication so far and the lack of staff assigned to it.
Yeah, so the politics here and the Sun-Times story goes into it. It seems that this official had some disagreements with other political appointees within the Johnson administration. And so all of a sudden, this guy's gone. And this was significant because he was really coordinating this plan to deploy these sensors to monitor the air quality in certain parts of the city. And now you're saying that there's no follow-up. This thing is kind of in limbo. Yes, there's been progress overall because these neighborhood groups have been advocating, but on the part of the city, you're not hearing much, and this is kind of just hanging out there right now.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know when it's going to happen. And, you know, it throws the whole thing into a very indefinite kind of state.
So have you reached out to the city? Have you said, hey, we're ready. We're ready to do this. The plan is in place. We just have to physically get out there and deploy these sensors. Have you tried to establish communication, and what's that been like?
The plan isn't actually in place in the sense that one of the things that needs to happen is determining where the sensors will go. And it, you know, it's very important that that actually has to be a collaborative community process where people can see, you know, can share their direct input about what they experience and say, hey, you know, I live over here and our air quality is terrible and we want to see a monitor. Or I'm driving past this thing every day, you know, and it's putting stuff out and I want to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very important process there that has to happen of community engagement to determine where the monitors will be placed. It's not going to be just about, you know, just putting them together and you know, getting them up. The city has said that they're going to assign new staff. We don't know who that is. We can't make plans without somebody to make them with. And based on what we've seen, like during the city budget hearings and kind of with the lack of communication here, it just doesn't seem like this is really a priority to them in the same way that it is to us. And I don't know what it's going to take to change that. But like, we're still committed to seeing these monitors go up, and we are still committed to having that reflect, you know, the experience of people around the city and wanting to know what they're breathing.
I want to just dive in here, sort of looking more broadly at the city. I mean, certainly politics is in this too, but you recently issued a report called Paid to Pollute, and this report really undercuts the city's claims that they care about the environment, really, when you break it down. I mean, this report is looking specifically at contracts. So can you tell us here, I mean, when we say, all right, let's take a look more closely at city contracts and the environment, what exactly are you focusing on in this report?
Sure. So kind of a lot of this interest, you know, and focus for me comes from what we see in our neighborhood, right? So Matt Asphalt is a city contractor. That's the bulk of their business. They got $140 million in contracts last year directly. So I wanted to take a closer look at the provisions that are in those contracts and kind of what are they required to do? Is anyone following through on those things? Because I think a lot of times we see emphasis placed on the creation of policies, or sometimes people focus on, you know, passing an ordinance or adding language to something. which can be important steps, but those things only matter if they are made to matter. And so there are, in some cases, pretty significant environmental provisions in these contracts that would allow the city to be tough if they wanted to. So, for example, there's stuff in there that says that just getting a citation, not even being found to have like actually fully committed a violation or whatever, just being cited by the city for an environmental violation would be enough to allow them. They call it an event of default. And it basically means that like the contractor has failed to uphold their end of the contract and the city can take action up to and including terminating it or barring them from future work. And there's requirements that those contractors, if you do get a citation, not just from the city, but from, you know, the state or from anybody that's related to an environmental violation, they have to report it to the Department of Law within 24 hours. Now, that's a requirement that's been in the city's commodity contracts since 2014. But I went and checked, and the Department of Law has no reports ever of anyone submitting these. So it's just no one's doing it at all. Actually, we, you know, after this report came out, the city budget hearings happened, and we were able to reach out to alders who were interested and who had signed on to a letter that we'd sent to the new procurement chief. And, you know, as these different departments came before the city council, you know, we're talking about like the Department of Public Health, right, which is nominally in charge of environmental enforcement, Department of Environment, who you would think would be in charge of something like that, the Department of Transportation, right, who's issuing the procurement request for the asphalt that they're going to use to put down the roads. And each time, you know, these departments are asked, like, are you responsible for knowing whether the vendors who receive these contracts are complying with the environmental requirements in them? And every time, they're like, well, that's not really our thing. You know, Department of Public Health is like, well, that's, you know, we don't have a role in procurement.
Yeah.
You know, they would say, well, we'll issue a violation to somebody if we find them doing a violation, but we're not tracking city vendors. You know, and Department of Transportation is like, well, we just know if we got the asphalt or not, you know, and Procurement Services says, well, like, we just put out the bids. And so there's literally no city department that considers it their responsibility to know whether these requirements are even being met, let alone do anything about it.
Yeah. So this is something, I mean, this is amazing. And we should know, we should all know about this. So as this is the first line in your report. You say, the city of Chicago does not enforce the environmental requirements in its contracts. It does not include environmental justice in its planning or account for the environmental impact of its projects. You go on to say, no city department enforces or monitors these requirements. There are no consequences for failing to meet them. There have been many environmental violations by city vendors, but no contracts have been canceled and no vendors have been disqualified. So you dive into this report really extensively here in this, the fact that the city is not enforcing its own environmental requirements when it comes to these contracts. No one's looking or no one's enforcing, no one's saying, hey, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. It's kind of just like a free-for-all here. And it really seems like Chicago is asleep at the wheel here when it comes to environmental enforcement.
That's definitely true. I think it's true more broadly, actually. We did another, this is sort of a follow-up to a report that we put out in 2023 called Ineffective by Choice that found that essentially environmental enforcement writ large is ineffective and that they choose not to do things that would actually interfere with the operations of the businesses that are systematically violating environmental laws. This report was kind of funny in a way because, you know, for paid to pollute, sometimes when you're doing research, your findings are, you know, what drives something, right? It's like you find something in the data and you can do an analysis based on it or, you know, finding different kinds of records. In this case, the report was really built around lack of records because it was just that everywhere we went trying to find records of compliance or records of monitoring or records of guidance, just no one had anything because nobody considered it to be their responsibility.
This is astounding. These environmental violations are allowed to continue when it comes to city contracts in Chicago. You mentioned that there's some aldermanic action here. I know you've reached out to elected officials, but here you've documented extensively this information, or lack thereof, as you're saying. There are definitely some blank spots in some of these documents that you include in this report, which is amazing. But where do we go from here? I mean, how do we affect change? The information is there. We see it here in this report. Again, it's called Paid to Pollute. But where do we go from here with this information that you have collected?
It's a good question. I mean, we're appreciative of the interest that we've seen from city council members. And based on the responses that departments provided during their budget hearings, maybe one path forward is, you know, as much as I mentioned that, you know, things that are written down need to be kind of made effective, I also wonder if it might not be necessary to have some kind of a clarifying ordinance that specifically attributes responsibility for monitoring the environmental compliance of city vendors to a particular department, so that there would at least no longer be uncertainty around that particular question. There are also a couple of things that the city could just choose to do. You know, if the administration wanted to start taking this seriously, they could be leaning on one of these departments and assigning responsibility themselves. And for that matter, I kind of want to highlight one additional thing, you know, that we called out here, which is that it was a new piece that was added to just like those asphalt contracts last year. They contained a provision that would allow the Commissioner of Public Health or the head of procurement to request additional documentation after the contracts were awarded. Documentation that could include traffic studies, air quality studies, even fence line monitoring. And that's something that, you know, would be at the expense of a contractor who's making a ton of money doing work for the city, voluntarily choosing to enter into a contract that has these provisions. The city just has to ask, but they haven't. So I guess one thing that we have made as a direct request to the head of procurement and to the Commissioner of Public Health would be to formally request that documentation that they are allowed to ask for under these contracts. You know, compared to other kinds of situations where there's questions about, you know, enforcement and the limits of business and whatever, part of what makes procurement such an interesting situation is that it's so cut and dried and voluntary. You know, it's like you can't say as a company that you don't know what you're getting into because you have chosen to engage in this process. And you've been given the contract in black and white, and you know what you're signing up for.
I think this is amazing. We need to keep this in the spotlight. And it's frustrating, too, because you want government to work for the people. And at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about here. It's people. It's the environment, how the environment is impacting the residents of Chicago. And there are a lot of folks like yourself who are fired up and they want, you know, there to be some enforcement when it comes to trying to protect the environment here. But politics and bureaucracy are kind of roadblocks when it comes to that. So the journey continues here, and it is a long road. I know that. And I know that you're working hard at Neighbors for Environmental Justice in terms of trying to get that sunshine on this issue and to really work for a better environment for Chicago. We could check out this report. Again, it's called Paid to Pollute. It's up on the website n4ej.org, the website for Neighbors for Environmental Justice. Anthony Moser is the board president of that organization. Anthony, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for all you're doing on behalf of Chicagoans and the environment here. And we, as always, have to keep an eye on the government here. And I know you're working hard to do that. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay. Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Black sheep going out to Midwestern.
Here we go once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. He's also a music historian, artist, and musician. And Steve, I mean, you know I love this music, this country rock. I mean, oh, it's so good. And this group, I gotta say, I've never heard of them before. J.D. Foster and Eastman, and they are pumping out some really cool tunes.
Totally. And you know, I think maybe people, they think Chicago, they don't think country rock. You know, it's right. Not necessarily the thing that springs into your mind. That said, different members were into different kinds of music in the band. Yeah, just great stuff. You gotta have some chops to play that stuff. You gotta have some nice harmonies. You gotta be able to play some twangy licks. It's people think it, you know, that there were, you know, maybe a glut of those kind of bands in the 70s, but for me, probably you, I'm always excited to hear a new one and hear their spin. And for a guy who doesn't even love the Eagles, you know, I like to hear the bands that were doing it on like a little more independent, less glossy level, and I usually love it.
Yeah, same. I'm right there with you, man. Well, let's talk about J.D. Foster and Eastman. This group, we're talking about the 1970s here, clearly. And the way that you kind of came across this band by the drummer, Steve Jones, tell us how you discovered this group.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even really take discovering's not the word. I just kind of got to sit back and Steve Jones sent me an email. He's like, hey, you kind of covered this band I was in before, Fawn, who are another band that there's parallels. They were really popular locally. You look at the bills they played and like you're like, wow, these guys were always playing like killer shows and clearly were playing all the time and were really like sort of a popular live, but they just never really got a recording out, you know, or like a big album deal, you know, with a label, let alone a recording out, you know. So, you know, they just really were beloved in the time and the crowd they had, but you know, unless you were sort of there, there's just not like a document of it. So these guys were sort of the same way. So Steve Jones kind of wrote me and was like, hey, this was my other band and we were pretty cool. And, you know, he played me some stuff, sent me some pictures of them all decked out, looking like they were either in like Santana or Poco or some combination thereof. And I'm like, you got my interest, buddy. And he's a really cool dude and has done a lot of other impressive stuff in other worlds of entertainment.
So he kind of brokered this possibility of an interview with guitarists Larry Foster and George Eastman of the band J.D. Foster and Eastman. So you got the story firsthand.
I mean, this is actually one of my favorite things, and I kind of forgot this. This doesn't happen quite as much as it did in the old days of Secret History, and we won't say part of the reason why, because maybe some of these guys aren't always with us anymore.
Oh,
but
yeah.
All these guys are, and you know, they've been in pretty loose touch, and I sort of was like, yeah, let's do this. You know, Steve, can you tell me the story? And he was just the drummer, and he came in a little bit later. So he's like, well, honestly, I don't know all the stuff. You should talk to all the guys. And you know, it sort of got the band back together a little bit, you know, to use a famous Chicago-centric sort of reference there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they all hung out and kind of shared their stories again. And I'm I'm CC'd on the emails and they're fast and furious now about who's got this tape. Does someone have a recording? Hey, it's the roadie. It's the roadie's wife. Oh my God. And everyone's it's building actually. So I really love when that, you know, happens and this music can sort of bring everybody back into it no matter what they're doing now, you know?
Right. So the band J.D. Foster and Eastman, how do they come together? I mean, what's sort of the origin story here?
Well, you know, everyone had slightly different backgrounds, but we're, you know, pretty much all, actually half the band were originally New York guys, but still sort of born and bred in Chicago. And then it's Larry Foster in the band. He maybe had the most experience out of anyone in the band. And he had bands going back to the 60s. He had a garage band called The Coachman, which there's a lot of bands called The Coachman.
Yeah. But
George Edwards, who was in H.P. Lovecraft, who were pretty important Chicago sort of folk garage into psychedelic band that moved to the West Coast. He was one of two main guys in that band. And then Skip Haines of Aliotta, Haines and Jeremiah, Lakeshore Drive fame.
That's right.
But yeah, basically, though, they all met up in their college years.
Right. So, okay, yes, Larry Foster, one of the guitarists, he's drafted in 1966, so he goes to serve. He's discharged in 1968. And pretty much, you know, after that, right, when they're here in the 70s, they start to kind of play that country rock, right? And they're playing around here, and it sounds like they're doing okay around Chicagoland. I mean, they're playing all over the place. And here's where they start to have a little bit of, you know, intersection with some people who know people and some producers, and people are digging what they're doing.
Yeah, it kind of started, they all met at IIT. Here, basically, so there are just some smart boys in this band here in Chicago. That was sort of where they all converged. It just sort of started loose jam sessions, I guess, some space maybe in Columbia College where they were jamming. But two of them kind of had a duo, and it basically started growing. You know, it was basically Larry Foster, Joe Eastman, JD. It kind of grew. It was sort of like a Crosby, Stills, and Nash thing. And then they were like, a la Eddie Young. They were like, let's make this more of a rock thing. If we're going to go play clubs, you know, let's make this a little more of a full sound kind of rock band thing. And that's when they added Steve. And okay, there's a keyboard player on some sessions too. And they added a bongo player later on, but yeah. So then they're pretty much off and running and hitting the clubs. And it sounds like the sort of Linkin Park area. There was a lot of players, a place called Ratzos, that they almost became like the house band.
And I like in your piece how they were reminiscing about the old days, and they couldn't remember some things. I mean, 50 years, right? That, you know, stuff is happening, and they couldn't quite remember. They think they were opening for some bands, but they can't quite confirm because they just can't remember.
George doesn't remember them opening for Willie Dixon, but he says they did, you know, so... And I've even seen some debate over the emails on like if tracks are recorded at the right speed and such like that. So, yeah, there's a little bit of this. If you can remember it, maybe you weren't there, you know, that kind of thing. I think they, you know, I think these boys probably partied and played the bar scene. And, yeah, some things might be a little bit foggy, and that's rock and roll. And then you hear they at least got a demo done. And they recorded this Streeterville Studios with Gary Loizo. I guess I've never known how you pronounce that, but seen his name quite a bit. He was in the American Breed, and then he was like produced Styx and REO Speedwagon and big bands like that. Pumpkin Studios, which comes up a lot, another band I talked to recently. Really good studio. So the demos sound fantastic, and the guy sort of let me put them up on a SoundCloud page so people could hear a little bit. And one song's real sort of beautiful harmonies and folky, and then another one's kind of like real roadhouse, and Eastman's leads are real like kind of southern rock with Skynyrd sounding, you know. It's a kind of rowdy, you know, so it's kind of you're kind of getting all the ends of sort of country rock.
Yeah, and look, this is the 1970s. These guys unfortunately don't last too long as J.D. Foster and Eastman. And one of them said that, well, how did it end? We got a manager. That was the beginning of the end. So
it's a classic tale.
Yeah, right.
You know?
So they're pretty much gone after, you know, a little while after that.
Seems like they got the manager. For some reason, they decided to replace Jones, and he was a little bummed, and they were bummed. Like, it seems like they didn't even want it, and sort of was not having the same chemistry. They brought in this bongo player, who I did hear a live recording of, and it's probably mic placement to a degree, but wow, he is taking over that show, and maybe... R.I.P. So we won't speak ill of the dead, and we did not name him and shame him in the column. But yeah, I think just, you know, they weren't. It wasn't really going anywhere at that point, and it sort of dissolved. But you know, good tale of these guys and good sounds. You know, most importantly, and herein I always get a thrill out of hearing these sort of demos and stuff that like. You know, no one has really heard since 1974 or whatever when they recorded it and shoved it in a closet somewhere. Maybe they played it for some friends or something, but cool stuff. And it seems like more, you know, photos and stuff's coming out of the archives a little bit too. So and they're all still with us. Bless them. So let's hope we see some more action from these guys.
I love it. I love the sound from J.D. Foster and Eastman. Coming out of Chicago, some good country rock coming out of Chicago. There's a bunch of it, man. You look through history. Oh, it's good stuff. And this just adds to it. We could get the full story of this group from the Secret History of Chicago music strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He's also a musician, music historian, and artist. Hey, Steve, I dig it. You know, I love this, especially this kind of music. It's awesome. And you just, you know, you get out there. I want you to just put on your cowboy hat, strap on your Fender, and rock and roll, man.
Yeehaw!
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 949 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN radio studio today. I hope you have a wonderful week. Happy holidays, whatever it is that you're celebrating. Enjoy. And I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.